Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we're taking a step off the news, frenetic news rat run that we're on often in this podcast, and talking about news stories and scientific developments. We're going to do one of our semi-regular kind of more theological reflective episodes. And today we wanted to talk about the concept of shame, guilt, grace, forgiveness, honor, and the idea that there is a kind of underappreciated or perhaps even forgotten element of the gospel, of the story of Jesus, which we have missed.
Yeah. So in my own journey on this topic, my own experiences of severe psychiatric illness and the sort of stigma that goes with that has made me reflect much more. But I also come across a wonderful book called Grace for Shame by John Forrester, a Canadian pastor, which is subtitled The Forgotten Gospel. And he makes the point that there's a very rich strand of teaching in the New Testament, and in fact throughout the whole Bible, about shame, which is, I think, to a large extent, it has been, if not forgotten, at least heavily downplayed. And so that's really why my interest in this topic and my conviction that this is a really important thing that we need to raise awareness of.
Mm. And I think, as we'll discuss in a second, it becomes increasingly pertinent today because many observers, many commentators have suggested, and I personally think there's a lot of merit to this idea, that Western culture that we are both raised in, and I suspect most of our listeners come from, has historically for hundreds of years been founded on a kind of guilt forgiveness posture, but it is now nudging towards an honor shame posture. And we'll explain what those kind of words mean. But actually, this is why it feels particularly relevant to think about what the gospel's kind of response to shame is. But first, let's kind of define terms. What do we mean by guilt forgiveness versus honor shame?
Yeah, so sociologists have been in this field dividing cultures across the world into what are often called high context cultures. These are shame orientated cultures, and low context cultures, and they're guilt orientated cultures. And historically, Western, particularly Anglo-Saxon cultures, have been regarded as low context, guilt-orientated cultures, whereas many other cultures around the world, and one can think of, for instance, Middle Eastern cultures or Far Eastern cultures, are much more high context. They shame and honor shame is a very central part of how relationships work.
Hmm. So to kind of be super crude about this, I guess a key part of the distinction is the question of how community oriented you are versus how individually focused you are. And so in kind of what we are calling low context guilt cultures, the critical question is, am I as an individual, am I a bad person? Have I done bad things? Whereas in a high context shame culture, the critical question is not, am I as an individual a bad person, but does my community view me as a bad person? Am I a disgraced, shamed, dishonored person in the eyes of others rather than the eyes of myself?
That's right. So that, hence the high context, the social context is very, very important in my own identity and how I'm perceived. And one of the interesting things about high shame cultures is by and large, it's a zero sum game. We can't all be top of the tree. We can't all be head honchos, the highly regarded, esteemed. And the more that I am esteemed, the less you are. And if you take away my esteem in the way you treat me, you do a mortal damage to me in my social role.
Mm.
And one of the things, when we were talking beforehand, you pointed out something that was striking in the history of the Second World War, which struck me.
Yeah, I remember coming across this idea as a kind of teenager for the first time when you're reading. I was quite into history and kind of military history a bit. And when you read about particularly the Pacific theater of the Second World War, where, you know, the Americans primarily are fighting the Japanese, and you have two like very, very industrialized, militarized societies in the, you know, mid-1940s fighting with very similar weapons over the same patches of land. And yet as these two armies and navies and even air forces came into contact, they revealed this like utterly different ethic of life. And so, you know, the Americans get absolutely baffled by the fact that the Japanese will do these things like banzai charges. So, you know, they will basically do it almost like a kind of suicide charge, bayonets fixed at the last, rather than be kind of allow themselves to be captured if they're losing a battle. And they'll just, you know, all these ordinary Japanese men will fix bayonets and just charge into the machine gun fire and get wiped out. Whereas when the Americans lose battles, they just raise a white flag and surrender and save their lives. And then you have, you know, you have the idea of, you know, the kamikaze pilots, you know, crashing, deliberately crashing their planes, turning their planes into bombs and crashing them into the aircraft carriers. And you have lots and lots of examples of Japanese officers who have, you know, seen one of their ships be sunk in a battle, or they've lost a battle somehow. And again, even if they're not at fear of themselves being captured, even if they could, you know, get on a plane and fly back to Japan, they very often choose to kill themselves. A kind of often this kind of ritualized seppuku, which comes from the kind of samurai era, horrible, you know, slitting your belly open with a knife, that kind of thing. And it's, you know, there's a lot of complex cultural history, and I'm not an expert on Japanese culture, but part of the story is that Japan is, at that time, certainly was a kind of shame on a culture. And the reason people would rather die than go back without their fleet or without their army back to the home nation of Japan is that it would bring unbelievable levels of shame and dishonor on them, a kind of form of social death. And actually, the only way to restore you and your family's honor, having suffered such a grievous defeat on behalf of the emperor, is to bravely, grim-facedly slit open your bowels and eviscerate yourself and die right, that way.
Yeah. Whereas you can hardly imagine one of the American generals who's just lost a battle sort of blowing their brains out because of the dishonor.
Exactly. They were, obviously, they didn't enjoy losing battles, and it was not a good thing. But there was no sense in which if a general loses a battle and is caught and spends the rest of the year in a POW camp and then is repatriated, do they bear the mark of Cain for the rest of their life? I don't think so. Is there a sense in which them and their entire community is ostracized and dishonored forever because of that defeat? No, I don't think so.
And obviously, this is a very black and white distinction. And in reality, of course, guilt operates in high shame cultures to some extent, and shame operates in high guilt cultures. So it's not a completely black and white thing. But nonetheless, it is a very interesting and fascinating distinction. And basically, in a shame culture, honor is more important than truth. Honor is weighed by the public in the court of public opinion. It's what people think, and preserving your honor is more important than being honest. And often this causes real difficulties when these, like in business, when these different cultures are trying to do business with one another. You know, and I've experienced this as a doctor working with some people from other cultures. You know, for instance, they may be working with me as a junior doctor. And when something bad has happened, you can see that they're terribly reluctant to actually tell the truth about what happened, because they feel that in some way either they're being dishonored or maybe I'm being dishonored as the consultant because... something bad has happened. It's been much better to preserve face and preserve honor. Whereas, of course, from a medical point of view, the really important thing is to know the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see that there's lots of institutions that have tried to address this, you know, by lowering the social consequences of revealing mistakes. You know, so I think the airline industry has this kind of culture of, you know, it is much, much better to report a mistake or a malfunction than not. And you're not, and if you come forward and say, look, I made a mistake, or this plane has this problem and it needs to be fixed, they've developed to try and develop a culture which says we're not going to, you know, drum you out and tar and feather you, because actually the most important thing is that the plane is as safe as it can be. And if that takes, you know, lowering the valence of shame and dishonor for people who've made those mistakes, then that's a price worth paying.
Yeah, although it's interesting that, in fact, the most, I think, I understand this to be true, that the most effective way that the airline industry has dealt with this is anonymous reporting.
Oh, is that right?
Of, you know, I did this catastrophic thing, you know, I tried to land without the undercarriage, and, but anonymous, you know, anonymous, airline pilot.
Yeah. So, the other aspect, right, just one more example where it kind of cuts between cultures, which a bit more closer to home, is what are known in the UK as kind of honour killings. I'm sure they take place in other countries as well, but this is where a kind of very tragic, though admittedly quite rare, cases where, you know, almost always women who have been seen, who are kind of from immigrant communities, who are living in the UK, who have seen to have dishonoured the family. So that might be, you know, they've entered into a sexual relationship with someone from a different ethnicity, or they have got divorced from their partner of the right ethnicity or something like that. There are lots of examples of where the fathers and brothers, the men of the family, basically ritually kill this woman as a way to restore the honour of the family in the eyes of their community. But this takes place not in the country of origin, but in the UK, where there is no culture of dishonour like that. And so we kind of, the, you know, the newspapers just kind of stare agape and aghast. How could a father behead his own daughter because she divorced the, you know, of course we understand that divorce is painful and has consequences, but the idea that it's so devastating, the only solution is murder, is kind of absolutely incomprehensible to us from our very low context culture.
Yeah, and so we're not seeing a rise in honor killing in the indigenous West, but we are seeing other examples of shaming and honor shame becoming more a feature of the contemporary culture, aren't we?
Yeah, that's right. I think there's a lot of observers would say, as I said at the beginning, that, you know, it's obviously a continuum. It's not a black and white, but that the West is nudging ever more along the continuum closer towards the honor shame end of it, and not. And in its own way, but particularly driven, a lot of people would say, by the growth of social media and the smartphone. So there's a very interesting, influential book about 10 years old called So You've Been Publicly Shamed by the journalist and writer John Ronson. And the kind of like example, the central story he tells is a story people might be familiar with of a woman called Justine Sacco, who was a kind of executive, and this is in the early days of the social media network Twitter, when people were kind of very unfiltered and just tweeting all the things. And she's waiting in the airport or something, climbs onto a plane, a trip from New York to Cape Town, and tweets this: going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS. Just kidding, I'm white. And then, you know, turns her phone off, or there was no Wi-Fi in those days, gets on the plane. And in the 11-hour journey, or so what it is, from I think she was stopping off at Heathrow, from Heathrow to Cape Town, this tweet goes viral on Twitter, picks up millions of views, and Justine Sacco is absolutely denounced. So much so that by the time she lands, she has found that her employer has fired her, and that she is the number one trending topic, and that there are celebrities queuing up to denounce her and encouraging all their followers to do the same. And John Ronson kind of, I mean, you know, side note, Justine Sacco is herself South African, a white South African, and says it was a poor taste attempt at kind of satire about health inequalities and the fact that she's more than aware that obviously white people can get AIDS, but she was making a kind of satirical joke about the fact that tragically AIDS is much more prevalent in black communities in Africa. But anyway, John Ronson kind of makes the case that social media kind of invites the narcissist in us out. We're all kind of invited to, or we early in the early days, to kind of pour all ourselves out there, and then it enables this kind of community of billions to scrutinize, and where they don't like what we've said, kind of heap opprobrium and shame.
And your life can be destroyed, can't it? I mean, people who have had this kind of massive shaming episode find it almost impossible to carry on.
I mean, you know, in this example, she literally lost her job. But there are, you know, countless examples as kind of what's sometimes called cancel culture, you know, is kind of kicked off, where the point is to impose a kind of social death. So you don't just, you target the employer and you try and get them to fire the person who has done something that this community has decided is shaming or dishonoring, who's broken the moral code. But then you also urge ostracism. And so you say, you know, none of their friends are allowed to talk to them or follow them on social media or appear, you know, be seen in public with them. And I've read plenty of accounts of people who say, you know, this starts online, but in certain subcultures, it's so strong that, you know, I've read lots of accounts of people who say, because I hold the wrong political views on a point of controversy, often very, very niche, I have real world friends who have completely dropped me. And sometimes they say privately, you know what, I don't disagree with you, but it is I cannot be seen to still be friends with you, because it would, your shame would then spill over onto me, and I would suffer social death, I would lose my networks, I might lose my job, I would lose my inability to feature inside this social circle.
So the whole social media world is, interestingly, has become a very high shame, high context culture. And it strikes me that particularly for young adolescents, given their first smartphone, it's a rapid education into a high shame context, where I discover every time I put out a post to my friends, it's being scrutinized. And the pecking order of who has the greatest status and the number of likes, and at any moment I could end up being shamed in front of all my closest friends.
Yeah, and obviously teenagers have always been kind of cliquey and formed groups and had pecking orders and tried to kind of bully and shame people. But there's something about the pervasiveness of social media and the fact that if you're a young person now with a smartphone, you're never out of that circle. Late at night in your own bedrooms, people are furiously messaging and gossiping and spreading rumors and trying to cancel and shame people. And the moral code is ever changing. If you said quite slightly the wrong things this month, but last month it was all right. And so understandably, young people grow up to learn that what is most important is absolute slavish adherence to the social norms. Otherwise, you can suffer that social death. You can be ostracized and shamed, and your friends will suffer vicarious shame by being associated with you. And then you can't just, you know, hide from it, because your phone is constantly pinging these notifications.
Yeah, and sort of moving away from internet, it's interesting also, it's been suggested that other aspects of modern culture, like, for instance, road rage, you know, someone gets cut up and then there is an explosion of why? Because I've been demeaned. My status as a driver is now being threatened. Or it's been suggested that murders or gun events in the USA, you know, which have risen massively, are often at their root is a sense of honor shame. You know, I've got to go and slaughter people in the local school because I feel I was demeaned. So it is interesting to see this trend. But then I'd just like to point out that I think that although it's still true that that certainly here in the UK we live largely in a low shame and high guilt and individualism, interestingly, I think the Christian community and local Christian churches are high shame communities and contexts.
What do you mean by that? Why do you think churches are high shame contexts?
Well, as I've spoken to people, and many people have said to me, people who are members of a local church have said to me, you know, there are things that I just could never say at church. I could never tell my pastor. I can go and talk to my GP. I can go and talk to an anonymous counsellor. But if this ever got out at the church, I would be destroyed. And sadly, one of the one of those issues which I'm aware of is of cases where people have concealed an abortion, either their own abortion or their child's abortion, because of the devastating consequences if it came out in the local church. So although we as Christians claim to believe in forgiveness, and that we don't want other people to know, it's and I think, and then a final example would be how it's relatively unusual to hear Christian leaders being very honest about their own struggles and failings. One of the things that struck me over the years is a number of preachers and teachers have talked to me in private about their struggles and about their maybe their loss of faith or their besetting sins or their sense of failure or whatever it is. And yet, when I listen to them in the pulpit, they portray a completely different sense of confidence in God and of triumphal sort of progress. And I'm just thinking, why is there this intense reluctance for leaders to be honest about their own failings?
And there's something particularly distressing when that happens in a church context. As you say, we are supposed to be a community of forgiveness and of grace. We know we're all individual stories of redemption. That's kind of hardwired into the gospel. And yet, you know, to use your initial example, you know, and I've read accounts of this, of particularly, you know, evangelical mothers whose teenage daughters get pregnant, and they would rather, you know, hustle the daughter off quietly for an abortion before they start to show, rather than live with the shame of having to bring their teenage daughter to church every Sunday for 9 months with her visibly growing belly and everyone knowing that she's not married and therefore she's failed because she had sex outside of marriage. And I just think, what has gone badly wrong here that people are prepared to end the life of the unborn child rather than suffer the ignominy of seeing that I failed as a Christian mother and didn't stop my daughter from having sex with her boyfriend. I just think it's just absolutely devastating how we've got to that position.
Yes. So I think just sort of moving on then, one of the interesting ideas is that the gospel first comes to a high shame culture in first century Palestine. Is a very high shame culture. And therefore we have to understand the way that the gospel is presented in the New Testament in the context of a high shame culture.
Yeah. And I think if we read it through the lens, a kind of post-Reformation, modern, Western, individualist, Enlightenment lens of the primary message of the gospel is Jesus came to deal with the individual sins of people, which is obviously true. But if we don't see the fact that he also came to deal with the shame, the communal sense, which is obviously a communal experience, you only feel shame when there are others around as well, then we miss a large part of what he is doing and saying and how radical his interactions with the first century Jews in Palestine and Judea that he was kind of seeing and meeting and interacting with in the Gospels.
That's right. And so the fundamental idea is that if you try to understand the good news about Jesus in an individualistic culture, inevitably you tend to think about, you know, Jesus died for me. Jesus died so that I can be forgiven. It's all interpreted in this individualistic sense. But if you read it through the eyes of an honor shame culture, you see that actually shame requires relational healing. It isn't something that is all about me and my sinfulness before Almighty God. It's about how I am seen and accepted. And so Whereas, and this formulation comes from John Forrester, grace, God's grace, good news for guilt is forgiveness, but God's grace, his good news for shame, is acceptance. And shame, another thing that illustrates, when I'm guilty, I feel terrible because I've done something. Hmm. When I'm shamed, I feel terrible because of who I am. The problem is with me, not as with my, with what I've done. And for so many people, that is the core of the issue. The core of the issue is not that I'm traumatized by these terrible issues that I've done. It's this feeling of sense of inadequacy, of shame, of not being the person I wish to be.
And this has relationship, doesn't it, with the idea that the German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer talked about, this, which he called cheap grace, that the church often misses, which is this idea that if we only address guilt and not shame, it's only half there. And, you know, if you have justification for the sin is made right. But if the sinner is not restored and made right, then it is, you know, in his language, cheap grace rather than the full gospel grace that Jesus offers. And you can see that very strongly, I think, in large elements of the gospels, where Jesus's interaction with people is not simply to address the fact that they need their sins to be forgiven, though that is, of course, very significant, but also that they need to be reconciled and restored in their community and seen to be made whole and made right.
That's right. And so I think this explains a quite a common pastoral phenomenon, I think, which is that someone goes to their pastor, church leader, and they say, in private, and they say, I feel terrible. I just feel that I've let everybody down and I've done these terrible things. And how can I ever be put right? And the pastor says, well, you know, you need to accept the forgiveness of God. So now I'm going to pray over you and I'm going to say that now God has forgiven you if you are truly repentant. And so the pastor prays the prayer, or the person prays the prayer and says, now you are forgiven. And the person says, yeah, but I still feel terrible. And that's because the primary problem was not guilt.
No. And so the solution cannot simply be pronouncing forgiveness, because shame is not something that you feel necessarily just between you and God, but something that you feel relationally, incarnationally, in community. And so it can only be expunged when your community visibly, outwardly demonstrate that they no longer consider you to be kind of cast out and beyond the pale.
Listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And it is interesting that when you read many of the New Testament encounters and examples of Jesus's of his forgiveness and acceptance, what you see is that often there is the primary element is about shame and acceptance. And so I think a classic example is the story of the prodigal son, which is so often has been preached as primarily about guilt and forgiveness, as though the prodigal son comes back to the father and says, I am guilty. I have done these terrible things. Please forgive me, Father. And the father says, you are forgiven. All your guilt has now been washed clean. But that's not the story. The story is that the prodigal son says, I have sinned. I have sinned against you and against heaven. But he then says, I am no longer worthy. Treat me as a hired servant. Put me down on the lowest rung because I'm no longer worthy. I have committed, you know, I have dishonored you. And then the father, completely unexpectedly and against all the social mores of the time, humiliates himself by running, but then honors his prodigal son. And his response is to clothe him. His nakedness, his immediate response is to clothe him with royal robes to put the ring on his finger and then to welcome him into a celebration meal, because the celebration meal is the classic incarnational communal act that demonstrates to everybody else that he has been restored to his position.
His fundamental problem was not that he had taken half of his father's money and squandered it. His fundamental problem was that he was estranged from his father and he needed to be restored to the position of being a son.
That's right. And interestingly, again, the zero-sum game is shown because inasmuch as the prodigal son is honoured, the older son is demeaned and feels it. You have effectively now spat in my face, father. You know, by taking this, doesn't he say, this son of yours?
This son of yours. Not his brother. This son of yours, yeah.
And the father turns it around and says, your brother.
Yeah. There's a lot going on in very few words there. I mean, there's a reason why people have studied this parable intensely for 2,000 years, but it's a very rich idea that the son is, and the son knows it, you know, he knows he's a Jewish lad who's now feeding pigs, you know, he's unclean, ceremony unclean. He's effectively spat in the face of his father and said, I wish you were dead, when he asked for his share of the inheritance. He is utterly, when he tramps up the road back to the village, he knows that everyone will recognize him and everyone will turn their eyes, close their doors and treat him as an outcast because he is worse than a pagan in the eyes of his Jewish culture. And yet his father is waiting for him at the threshold, sees him a long way off, hitches up his robes, an older man, and runs, something an older man would never do, takes the social stigma and the shame upon himself by embracing his son and says, you know, you are shamed. And there is a kind of almost a propitiatory transfer of shame, isn't there?
Yeah.
He takes shame on himself so the son can be honoured.
He does. And of course, that was a central element of the New Testament preaching of the church, of the cross. That's what the cross was. The cross was the way in which Jesus shamed himself. God in the person of Jesus takes on the ultimate shame in order that our shame should be covered.
Mm. And that idea of covering is obviously a very rich theological metaphor because it goes all the way back to Genesis 3 and the first sin in the fall. And what immediately after they eat the fruit and they've disobeyed God, Adam and Eve suddenly are what? They are ashamed of their nakedness. And so they sew together fig leaves to try and cover themselves because they suddenly realize we are naked and we have to be covered. And then there is that kind of prophetic act when God casts them out of the garden, but doesn't cut them off forever because he provides animal skins. The death is needed for something else to die so they can be covered. And then it's reversed on the cross when Jesus is stripped naked, his clothes are cut away from him and divided up by the Roman soldiers. He dies naked so that we can be covered by his spotless royal robes.
That's right. In Hebrews, Christ endured the cross and despised the shame and is now honoured and glorified. And he offers his honour to us so that we too can be accepted.
And we often harp on the suffering, don't we, of the cross. When we moderns read the Gospels, we are struck by the cruelty and the pain, which is obviously horrendous. But for the people there, what the reason the Romans crucified people wasn't just because it was an exceptionally sadistic way to kill people, but it was because it was publicly shaming, because you were naked, arms outstretched, raised up on high, and this was a special form of execution reserved for rebels and slaves, terrorists, renegades. The more chilling point to Jesus's followers is not just that the Messiah is going through agony, but that he has been exposed to unbelievable public disgrace. And the church has kind of almost flinched from that, hence why every painting you've ever seen Jesus on the cross shows him wearing a loincloth, because the idea of him being literally naked, which is exactly what would have happened, is unbearable.
Mm. And of course, there is strong Bible basis for the sacrificial element, the sacrificial lamb, the paschal lamb whose blood was shed.
Well, the scapegoat, is cast out, bearing the sins of all the people.
Yes. So we're not in any way saying that this is not, that the forgiveness, the substitutionary forgiveness is not part of this message of the cross. It's just that this other element of it it seems to has been rather very much downplayed as being another aspect of the wonderful good news. Why is the cross good news for shamed people? Mm. It's good news because it points to our covering. It points to and that wonderful line, "In royal robes I don't deserve. Mm. I live to serve your majesty." That is such a brilliant encapsulation of the fact that we are dressed in royal robes that we don't deserve. And therefore we are seen, we are honored, we are respected, we are given dignity, and accepted into the Christian community.
Because some people in culture and even in the church, I think, would conclude that the response to if you feel shame is to turn that around and declare yourself to be shameless and say, why do I need to be covered? There's nothing wrong with me as I am. Take me as I am. You know, and you could even, you know, tentatively suggest, you know, there are elements of that in the kind of pride culture in LGBT communities, where having experienced, you know, centuries of shame for who they are and what they do, as they kind of came out of the darkness in the 1960s and homosexuality was legalized and things like that, their response is pride, is to say, this is who we are. We're going to march down the main high street of your town in a pride march, saying that we are not ashamed. We are proud of who we are. We are shameless.
Yeah. So, and again, it's interesting to unpick that, isn't it? So, because of course it was true and is true still that people who are same-sex attracted or, you know, have other unconventional orientations and so on, often have an intense social stigma.
Mm.
But the response, which is of one of shamelessness, I'm now, because I have been shamed, I'm going to be as outrageous, as socially outrageous as I possibly can. You know, you sometimes see this, don't you, in the gay pride movement, where you've got drag queens and so on dressing in such a way as to be as offensive as possible, as outrageous as they possibly can be, to quote the straight majority. So this instinct for shamelessness, actually, I think counsellors would often say that actually is kind of a perverted kind of shame. It's still shame operating in a sort of complex psychological mechanisms. So interestingly, the Christian response is not shamelessness. You can now be as outrageous as you want, but is almost a kind of godly modesty, that I don't need to strut my stuff, because I know that I have real value. And, you know, interestingly, I mean, this has just occurred to me, but it's a particularly British thing about the royal family. You know, the people who are trying to increase their social status, they, you know, often will live in the most ostentatious way, and they will dress in an incredibly overstated way, and they'll be dripping with gold, and they'll look completely, you know. But, you know, the British royal family, who are the real deal, often delight in turning up with, you know, very ordinary, even shabby clothes.
Yeah.
Because the Queen used to, the now late lamented Queen Elizabeth, used to delight in being found in rather dowdy clothes on her estate and being mistaken for
hiker or something, granny.
But the point is, she had nothing to prove. She had absolutely nothing to prove. She was so secure in who she was that she didn't have to act it out.
Mm. I mean, when you were talking earlier about the Christian response to shame, I was struck by thinking on the story of Jesus and Zacchaeus, where another person who would be utterly dishonored, who was despised and hated and shamed, disgraced, again, in his kind of Jewish first century context as a collaborator with the pagan Romans and someone who was regularly corruptly stealing taxes and money as a tax collector. And Jesus' response to that is not solely to say, "Zacchaeus, you terrible person, stop doing all of that." He says, "Zacchaeus, come down, I must eat with you today." So he says, I take away your shame by saying that I will come and enjoy your hospitality. I will enter into this house of a sinner risking the shame, you know, almost transferring the shame of Zacchaeus onto himself. Zacchaeus' response when he realizes how much God loves him despite his sin is not to revel in his shamelessness and say, oh my gosh, I can just carry on because Jesus has accepted me. His response is restitution and is to say, I will, you know, repent and I will no longer act this way. I will, you know, pay back people I've cheated and four times over or whatever it is.
That's all right. It's remarkable, isn't it? So yes, there was guilt. Zacchaeus was both shamed and guilty. But his shame was so overwhelming that he couldn't hear the good news about guilt until he heard the good news about shame. And I suspect that is true for so many people in a modern society, and why sometimes it seems that evangelistic preaching just fails to engage, because so often evangelistic preaching is focusing on guilt and forgiveness. But people need to hear the good news about shame and acceptance before they can hear the good news about guilt and forgiveness.
And that's challenging, isn't it, for the Christian and for the evangelist and for the Christian leader, because it's one thing to say, I was guilty and now I'm forgiven. You too can go on that same journey of forgiveness. But it's a different thing to say, I was ashamed and now I have been covered. You too, who are ashamed, can be also covered. That's a much more vulnerable thing to say. It requires a lot more deep security to bear your shame and your dishonor, your previous shame and dishonor that has now been dealt with by Jesus.
It does. As you say, it needs this sense that because my shame is covered at a very deep level, and because I'm reveling in that security, now it's not such a big thing for me to share some of these failings with others. But I do know how powerful it can be when a preacher who is often highly respected and looked up to, speaking from a place of security, is able to share some of their own struggles. That, because that can be enormously liberating and empowering for those who feel constantly inadequate and shamed. And I think this is a very Christ-like thing, that Christ steps into that place. However, it's interesting, isn't it, that I'm just reflecting the fact that what the abuse scandals involving Christian leaders have pointed out is that I suspect there's a strong honor shame element there, that the abusers were maintaining their status and concealing what was actually going on, because for them, maintaining honor was most important. And then paradoxically, the others, once they became aware of it, other leaders, their instinct was to protect their honor and the honor of the organization as well.
Or even sometimes mistakenly, perhaps the honor of God himself. You know, this idea that if you've read, I've read that before from people who are trying to justify why they didn't, you know, report their leader or an abuser in their midst. And they said, well, if we did, people would start to think less of the Jesus that we are preaching if they realize that we're actually a bunch of hypocrites. And so we cannot allow our shame from our failings to besmirch the good name of Jesus in our community and in our culture. And so therefore the godly thing to do is to cover this up, which is just a tragic misstep.
Yeah, and it does illustrate the complexities, you know, because one of the interesting things that I read again in Forrester's book is that in an honor shame culture, and as we said, the Christian church tends to be an honor shame culture, then when our leader is dishonored, the entire community is dishonored.
Yeah.
And so therefore there's a strong tendency for the followers to wish to retain the honor of their leader,
yeah,
rather than to acknowledge their failings. And so This again, I think you can see a mechanism whereby there's an enormous reluctance to, there's a loyalty to the leaders and a reluctance to believe that they could be other than what they appear to be. So this this honor shame.
Mm. I mean, to go back to that initial example we talked about at the beginning, one of the reasons why, you know, a Japanese admiral who's been defeated in a naval battle might kill themselves is not just to save their own family from dishonor, but is to restore the honor of all the underlings, thousands of people working on the ship who might be piling into lifeboats as we speak. You know, if one person must die by going down with the ship to restore the honor of all the other sailors on board, so they're not covered by having to be associated with the dishonor of the guy at the top. And I think something happens in reverse in church institutions, you say, where people say, well, if it becomes known that our charismatic celebrity pastor is actually a fraud and a charlatan and an abuser and a cheat and a bully, they'll think that we who followed him and planted churches and built this institution are all just as guilty and as broken and as awful as them. And so the worst thing in the world would be for the truth to come out.
And so these are, you know, again, it's a complex mix, isn't it? Trying to find this right balance between genuinely trusting in the faithfulness of God and in his acceptance and in whilst at the same time maintaining truth and integrity. It's not that these things don't matter.
No.
And also seeking leaders, therefore, who have a personal experience of this acceptance, who have and therefore the security, the personal security to be able to welcome others and not to seek their own honour.
No.
And I do think there's a lot about celebrity Christianity, which unfortunately just taps into all this, where we over honor high status individuals, you know, A-list celebrities in the Christian world, and which is so antithetical to this modesty, this genuine desire to remain hidden and not to seek the highest place.
Because I think the point you said Forrester makes in the book is that there is a kind of godly modesty, which is not the same as shame, but is not totally unrelated. You know, there's a kind of, there's the shame for our mistakes and our failings that Jesus comes to address, but there's also a virtue in a kind of godly modesty that doesn't seek to be shameless.
That's right, and which respects and accepts others. So basically, we need this to be modelled. It's not good enough to preach about it. We need to model to one another what genuine acceptance in the gospel, what clothing in those royal robes, what it means. And we need to do it incarnationally. So we need to demonstrate to the people who are shamed, but incarnationally, by the way we treat them, by welcoming them to our table. So interestingly, eating together in the New Testament, I mean, that's a common thing, isn't it? Table fellowship with Jesus. Mm. You know, who did he eat with? So often it was with the shamed and the non-entities. And by his sharing the table with them, he was demonstrating acceptance. And I think that's true today, that hospitality.
Yeah.
Welcoming people who are shamed, treating them with respect, is an essential part of living out the gospel.
And again, to go back to that example of, you know, evangelical Christians who feel the need to quietly usher their teenage daughters away to have an abortion because they can't bear the shame. You know, how do you address that? Well, it's by very publicly and including and honouring those in our communities who are in this context, who are pregnant outside of wedlock, and saying, not that we think that we approve of necessarily of that action, but that we do not shame people, we do not ostracize and separate out from those who have fallen or who have made mistakes or who have living with the consequences of their poor choices. And that therefore gives people confidence that if they, in this example, you know, fell pregnant outside of wedlock, it would be they could still be accepted. They will not be dishonored by coming to church every Sunday with a visibly growing pregnant stomach. They don't need to deal with that because they're not going to be dishonored.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. So if the community is modeling that kind of acceptance, you know, not just for people who are pregnant outside marriage, but also for single mothers, divorced families, you know, messy
reality of life that exists in every congregation, but is mostly covered up.
That's exactly right. If instead they are being honored and treated with respect and are treated with equal status as everyone else, then that, I think that hopefully is creating a kind of, and of course it's a very countercultural thing. And maybe, you know, maybe we should be drawing to a close here, but maybe this is one of the ways in which, you know, we could live as a countercultural community, which was genuinely accepting, where God's this hospitality, this sharing of fellowship, of welcoming strangers who are shamed and low status, that would be a remarkable witness in a high shame culture.
Yeah, I mean, it's not my observation, but, you know, historically, maybe a couple of generations ago, the church was seen in Western culture as a kind of a moralizing, holier-than-thou space. And if you were, you know, a bit broken, a bit flawed, wearing your scars, if you'd fallen short, if you'd made mistakes, the safest place to be was outside the church, where people were much more accepting. And I think we are certainly in wider secular culture moving away from that towards a more rigidly enforced moral code. It's a very different moral code to the one the church adopts, of course, but it's ruthlessly enforced. And perhaps part of the church's mission and ministry in this coming century is to be the opposite, is to be a place of radical acceptance, not without, you know, watering down what we believe in God's standards of holiness, but saying actually the church can be a hospital for people who have been cancelled and shamed and dishonoured and cast out and ostracised by wider society. And we model a way of saying actually there is a way of welcoming in the dishonoured and the shamed and the disgraced and the humiliated that you don't find anymore in non-church contexts.
Yes, and I think just again, very interesting, going back to Zacchaeus, and you see that in other stories as well, that acceptance comes first and then forgiveness comes later. And therefore, if as communities we are practicing acceptance, then that's the priority often. And then the gospel for guilt can become revealed once the gospel for shame has been carried out.
It's not, again, not my observation, not my words, but you'll have come across the idea that churches operate tacitly on this idea that first, not outsiders have to behave, they have to change their behavior, then they need to believe and believe the right things, and then they can belong to our community. But actually what Jesus models and the way the churches should be is the exact opposite. Everyone should be invited to come and belong to our community. Then you can be invited to believe what we believe. And only then will we start to expect for you to actually behave the way that we behave.
Yeah, well said.
And just as a final closing thought then before we wrap this up, you observed to me off mic before we talked that actually there's a fascinating counterpoint to the shame, idea of shame in the Gospels, which is that in the book of Acts, after Jesus's shameful death and then resurrection, one of the most common adjectives described of the disciples is boldness, paresia in the Greek.
Yeah, so it's a word which is worth looking out for, how often that occurs in Acts and elsewhere in the New Testament, that the followers of Jesus spoke the truth with boldness. And it was one of the characteristics of the preaching of the gospel in the New Testament era. And then the question is, well, how could that happen? They were so ashamed. They were so, how could this tiny little minority of pathetic and shame, you know, they're here.
Whose leader had the humiliation of public crucifixion.
You know, they were social entities. Where did this boldness come from? And so it's interesting, isn't it, that I think this is the difference between, it's not shamelessness.
No.
But it's from their security, from their utter conviction that Jesus had risen from the dead and that the gospel was good news, they had the followers had this characteristic of boldness. So it's boldness from security. It's boldness from confidence. Mm. So it, interestingly, therefore, it's this modesty, which is this Christian modesty, doesn't mean that you end up as a kind of shrinking violet.
No.
Paradoxically, knowing that I'm fully accepted by Christ allows me then to be bold in and to have this confidence, this humble confidence.
Yeah, knowing that your shame has been appropriately covered by Jesus's death and resurrection liberates you. You don't have to live as people of shame anymore, scurrying and hiding in upper rooms, but you can stand out on the balcony like Peter does and preach to thousands of people at Pentecost, or you can stand up before the Sanhedrin, the people who put Jesus to death a matter of weeks earlier, and tell them what had happened and who Jesus was, because they knew that their shame had been appropriately dealt with and that their dishonor had been covered. Right, let's wrap it up there. Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you found that interesting. We'd love to know your own thoughts on this topic, particularly about the idea of where kind of shame and dishonor culture intersects with both the church today and also kind of wider society, social media, etc. Do let us know your own thoughts. And also, if you have any suggestions for other things we could talk about, news stories to respond to, other issues in culture and technology or medicine and ethics, you know where to reach us. It's MOLAD, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. There's lots of interesting resources on all kinds of topics on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com, W-Y-A-T-T. Or you can find out some of my journalism on my website, tswyatt.com. We'll be back next week with another episode, but until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.